My name is Joe Sprange. I'm a husband, a dad, a business owner, a triathlete, an under-8s rugby coach, and I love talking to people. I started running fun runs when I was 6, and I've recently completed my 50th triathlon. I've worked in advertising and marketing, but now I own my own personal training business. My goal is to be the best I can be as a husband, a dad, triathlete, boss, coach. So I love asking others who I respect the secrets on how they've got to where they are today. My passion is about finding the key to unlock potential. So that's what my podcast is all about. I interview everyday people who perform at extraordinary high levels, and I collect a bunch of those keys and I share them with you. This is High Performance with Joe Sprange. Hit subscribe now to stay up to date with our latest podcasts. So welcome to the first episode of High Performance with Joe Sprange. I've got my wonderful friend Nick Fisher joining me today for the first episode. Nick is a real legend. He's an Olympian. He runs an engineering company, and he's also a husband and a father of two lovely children. And I'd like to start today by one of my most vivid memories of Nick's skiing career was when he was trying to qualify for the Olympics. And we were having a barbecue at his house, and his girlfriend of the time and now wife was with me. And we knew that Nick needed to get a certain number of fizz points in his competition in the lead up. And I remember we were sitting on the website back then. There weren't live streams. It was that long ago. It was the end of 2005 or beginning of 06, I believe, Nick. And we kept refreshing. Now, where were you skiing then, and what did you need to do?
Where was I at that point in time? I think I was in... At that particular event, I was in, was it Lake Placid?
Yeah.
Or was it, it wasn't Mont Tremblant. It must have been I think it was Lake Placid at that point in time.
Yep.
And I had to make the top, only the top half of the field. Yep. The rules were at that point in time, I had to make the top half of the field in yep. half the events leading into the Olympics to qualify. And in the first four events, I'd done it twice. And yep. then we had a double event at Lake Placid, which was yep. two events, consecutive days. Yep. And so I had to get it on one of those days. I had to get that qualification mark again. I got it on the first day. So I banked it nice and early, which was a relief.
Fantastic. Okay, so I've got to the punchline a little bit already by you made it to the Olympics. Do you remember going skiing? Do you remember starting out skiing as a kid?
I certainly do remember starting out skiing as a kid. I loved it.
What was your first skiing memory?
I've got a memory that sits in the back of my head of riding a Pommer somewhere. Now, I'm pretty sure... Again, speaking about how long ago this all was, I'm pretty yeah. sure it was the Pommer at Mount Buller, which is a yep. surprising place. I'm pretty sure it was the Pommer at Mount Buller at the time, I believe, Burke Street. But, you know, I'm talking when I was 4 years old now, so let's not get too carried away.
So we're 4 years old skiing with our mum.
Skiing with mum, yep.
Yeah, awesome. That's fantastic. And when did you start to realize that skiing was something that A, you were good at, and B, you really enjoyed doing?
Well, I think I always really enjoyed doing it, so that was yep. never in the question. When did yep. I figure out I was good at it? I got probably my first memory of going, oh, maybe I do know how to ski, was probably my first ever inter-schools race. So I signed up in the event as a team. Yeah, you're Yeah. We're in a team of four, and you went yeah. in the racing events, which is what yeah. we all did back then. We had five kids at our school, and
okay.
so one of the kids missed out on the team. Five kids in the school that wanted to go in the skiing event, that is. His mother went to my mother at the time, so I was like year six at school, so I'm 11 or 12, and said, would you go in the moguls with my son? Or would Nick like to go in the moguls with my son so he can have a race, because he wants to go in an event and you only need two in the moguls, whereas yep. you need four to make another racing team. So we're sure, I'll do yep. that. Never skied moguls before in my life at this point. And turned up at the event, skied my run, crashed, finished on one ski. But that was still good enough to send us through to the next round. And we made fantastic. We made the state finals at that point. So
how old were you then?
11 or 12.
And when did you start to go, this is something I want to prioritize over other things in my life? Like, when did you go, hey, I don't want to play rugby or soccer or whatever because I want to ski?
I focused very hard on it. It was a different world back then. I focused very hard on it through high school. But I didn't go overseas training on training camps or anything like that until after I actually left high school. So I'd say I was very serious going through school, but being a different world in skiing back then, you didn't just, you know, the sort of facilities weren't there to go on these long trips, long training experiences overseas, especially in mogul skiing, which was, you know, in its, I won't say infancy, but it was a, you know, not a mainstream skiing sport at the time anyway. So I was very competitive and took it very seriously. But I wasn't doing any international competitions or anything like that until after I left high school.
So a question, I coach my little son's rugby team, and I'm constantly thinking about how I can be a better coach to him. And, you know, every dad wants his son to play for the Wallabies. What advice would you give to a dad in terms of, you know, you've had a successful sporting career and obviously your mum's played a big role in that. I'm sure your father as well. What advice would you give to a parent to sort of help cultivate their kid's sporting career?
So it's an interesting question, that one, because obviously skiing is not a mainstream sport, or at least especially back then. So I think the one thing that my dad did was let me make my own decisions on it. So he, whilst he encouraged me, he allowed me to go and find that myself. It didn't come from direction from him or them as parents. They let me go off and make my own decision, which, being a parent now, is really hard to contemplate. On you know, you want to push your kids in the right direction, not force, but you know, you want to encourage them to go and, you know, try these things and you know, try and try to develop in certain areas. But I find the one thing that's one thing I really realized, that I was given the benefit of picking something quite alternative and being given the opportunity and then encouraged all the way through to go with that. Now, my mum was a mad keen skier as well, absolute mad keen skier, loves it. And what she did for us was, so both, but by us, I mean both me and my sister, we both did a lot of skiing. She enabled it to happen. So, you know, she would drive us down there every weekend, would, you know, put her life on hold to go and do that. Dad, and then dad would sit there and, well, he worked. So we'd go away skiing for long periods of time, be away all winter, and he stayed and worked, and that was, you know, that's pretty tough.
It is
pretty tough for his whole family to sort of go away for months at a time. But they gave me the space, and they gave me the encouragement and the ability to go off and give it a go.
So it's really interesting. All the things you talk about, they're all positive inputs. There's no yelling at you if you failed. Tell me, did you ever want to quit? Was there you in year nine and you know, thought you were going to win the state champs or something like that, and you went, no, I hate this, mum, I want to stop?
I have two distinct moments through my career where I literally had made the decision to quit, which is obviously a very big one, and it normally happened. It didn't happen on big events, like you know, not winning or crashing in an event was never a trigger to it. They didn't help, but they weren't the triggers to it. I think it was just being ground up and into the ground, long periods of training, often out in really bad weather. You're freezing cold, you're wet, you're miserable. And so one of them was, in Australia, driving down from the hill one afternoon after probably, I think, 6 weeks of just grind of monotony, repetitive, stuck out in bad weather and probably not doing very well at the time. And I remember sitting in the car driving down from, would have been down from ski trip to Jindabyne, and just sitting there thinking, I'm just going to keep driving.
Yeah.
I'm just going back to Sydney.
Yeah.
That's it. I'm done.
Is this a kid? As a kid or as an adult?
Adult. Yeah. This would have been as an adult. Yeah. It would have been after I'd left high school. As a kid, I never did, but like I said, as a kid, I don't think I really stepped into trying to get to a higher level until after I left school anyway. The second time it happened to me, I was in Europe. We were training in France, again, a long training camp grind. It was freezing cold. We're at the top of the French Alps, out in the freezing cold, hiking jumps again. And just, you know, my feet were frozen. Bottoms of my feet, I couldn't feel it. They'd been frozen. They'd been like that all day and for days on end. And I wasn't getting any better. I was probably getting worse at the time. And again, that's the second time I remember going, I wanted to stop. Quit and just, you know, ask my dad. My dad was a very good 400 meter runner when he was a kid.
Yeah,
and asked him, you know, what was it like when you stopped? Why did you stop? Why? And one of his answers was he had gone to uni, he stopped, and he enjoyed the uni life. He was going out. He had friends. He was doing all that sort of thing. And maybe I got the whole story. Maybe I didn't. Again, it's a long time ago. But I remember sitting there thinking, don't stop over something you'll regret later. It's painful. It hurts. Right now, you don't want to be here. But what are you going to do when you get home that's going to be so much better? And thought that through. And on both these occasions, came to the same result. It's not worth it. Just keep turning up.
It's very interesting. Was there a point in time in your before you finished school where you think the Olympics was something that was on the cards? Like, were you in year nine and you won the state champs? You thought, gosh, maybe I could go to the Olympics one day, or was it just this thing you were passionate about?
I think it was just something I was passionate about. I never had the call it self confidence to actually believe I ever would make it to the Olympics. I never thought. I was that good. Like, I remember when I started skiing moguls, there were guys my age, maybe a year older or so, but who were unbelievable. You know, these guys had already been to junior world championships. They'd already won junior world championships. They were doing backflips and competing at national competitions and skiing. And I was like, oh, this is great. I love this sport. I'm gonna do it. But, you know, these are the good guys. When you're surrounded by people, you know, the step above them, the guys above them are the ones on World Cup. And you're like, well, no. So did I sit there going, I'm going to be better than them. I'm going to make it to the Olympics. Actually, no. I was there just like, I really enjoy this. I love it. I'm going to keep doing it. And then I'd get those little wins every now and then that make you go, okay, no, maybe I can. Maybe I can be better than what I thought before. And so you're like, okay, well, I'll keep going because I've just closed that gap a little bit. So I'll go again. And then that would keep me going and going and going. And then I'd make another little increment and edge closer to them or go past them. And all of a sudden you're going, oh, okay. And then it only really ever ticked. I didn't really click until probably I was on, would have been my third or fourth year on Europa Cup, which is the level below World Cup.
For the listeners out there that haven't, that World Cup is where the sort of Olympic level athletes compete sort of week to week, if you like. And so Europa Cup's that step down. So it's like reserve grade in rugby league, basically.
Yep. Thanks, Joe. That's right. And anyway, turned up first event of the new year. And I came second.
Oh, wow.
And I, you know, best I'd done before was maybe a ninth, and that was a one-off. And behind that, it was, you know, maybe 20th, you know, something along there.
So were you talking 2003 here or something?
That would have been about 2002, I reckon it was. 2002, 2003.
I've got your Fizz profile up here. Fizz, I can
confirm
that, yeah.
and that's when I went, oh, okay. That this is a reality now. But it took, you know, it took a long while for that to really sink in that actually I could do it.
Yeah. So we're probably talking, what's that, 10 years since the primary school, hey, can you be the extra kid in the mogul team, right?
Yep.
I want to touch on something you've said there, because I think it's really interesting. And you said, I didn't have the confidence to think I'd be good at this. And you were clearly a good skier, right? Because you were better than the vast majority of people in Australia, but there were kids that were better than you. So you kind of felt like you weren't good. What impact do you think that feeling had on you in terms of skiing?
As in the impact it had on me mentally?
Yeah. Like, do you think it made you a better skier? Yeah. Do you think it made you train harder, or did it make you not enjoy skiing?
No, I don't think it... didn't make me not enjoy skiing. I still really loved it.
Because the thing I think in this is that we have our actual self, and then our perception of ourself, right? And I think a lot of people that are high performers look at themselves and they think that they're 7 out of 10 at whatever particular thing. So I'm a 7 out of 10 skier, right? But I want to be a 9 out of 10 skier. So I'm going to train super hard because I think I'm 7 out of 10, right? And the reality is they're actually a really good skier and they're 9 out of 10 in the first place. And that thinking that they're not very good at it drives them to be that elite level. Where the opposite is that kid that's really talented. He thinks, hey, I'm 9.5 out of 10 because he doesn't work hard, doesn't train hard. He doesn't think he needs to be that good. And I often just think those people that lack a bit of confidence in themselves in a field are sometimes the ones that work hardest to get to that next level, you know? And I just think it's interesting that you were doing, you know, like for me standing here, I would love to have been competing in a sport like this at the level that you've been. And you talk about, you know, it's just sort of lacking the self-confidence to believe that you were really good at this.
Yeah. So I think what I found when I was coming through in those, you know, through the ranks, through the younger years is whilst there were these guys that were excellent, there was a lot of people that weren't them as well. So we were still surrounded by people who were normal. Not these guys. And so although we were all friends and we all got along, you'd sort of come up with these little rivalries with people at a similar level at the same age. And so those little rivalries is what got us going. I had a mate, Kent, who I skied with for quite a number of years, and we played off each other, and that was great. And then, you know, when years passed on, it sort of changed to someone else, and you get a little rivalry. And so whilst I wasn't saying, well, I'm going to pick the top guy and go for them, you still had a lot of good, healthy competition with those around you. And I was happy with that. That was enough for me to keep turning up and putting my best in.
So we finished school. You decide you want to go to uni. Tell me about that transition for you, because I know for myself, you know, I finished school and not dissimilar to you, you know, I wanted to be a cross-country skier because I thought that would be a really cool, fun thing to do. And I didn't have what was needed to take me to the level that you went to. Talk to me about that journey. What did you study? Why did you want to study it? And also, where did skiing play? Was skiing coming first and uni was second?
I pretty much kept them par on par. So yeah. I was always gonna go to uni. I was never not going to do that. Yeah. And so it almost wasn't a decision as to whether that was even on the cards. You look at it and go, okay, I could take a year off. Mm-hmm. Some people did, or I could push off study to go and ski. And while that option was there for me, again, I hadn't done much travel overseas, and at the time we weren't doing a huge amount of travel overseas, so it wasn't insurmountable to be able to do it. And I think I just went in on the fact of, well, I'm going to start uni because I'm here, and I'll make it work. And that's how I approached it.
And what was the journey? Did you, you know, do you need to qualify for a junior team? Did you, you know, how did you sort of engage with skiing once you're a kid? Because I know in a lot of sports that once you sort of finish school, the pathway narrows, and if you're not looking pretty good, it can be hard to sort of, you know, stay involved and be supported.
Yeah, so first year out of uni, I got selected for the one level below World Cup team, yeah, which cool. was the Europa Cup team at that point in time.
Wow.
So the year after I finished school, I went overseas and did a long training camp for the first time at the level below that again, which was really just a training camp. There was not much more to it than that. After my first year of uni, got selected to go up onto that next level. So whilst I didn't necessarily have a time pressure on to do that. that's what eventuated.
Yeah.
And had that not have happened, I may have been put in a different situation and would have had to make a more tougher decision.
And what was happening training wise then? Like, you know, having known you for a while, I've seen your athletic prowess even as a 40-year-old. You're a pretty fit dude. What were you doing? Obviously, what was a normal training week when you were sort of getting to this level where you're becoming a senior athlete and, you know, competing at this international level? What were you doing each week?
So if we look at what we were doing when we're at home, so, you know, starting basically we'd do your typical gym workouts again, because we were in a very underdeveloped sport at that point in time. We didn't have fitness coaches really, especially that early on. So the university, once you got on, joined the university sports teams, we got a bit of coaching out of them and some fitness training from the uni, although it wasn't skiing specific. They helped us out.
Yeah.
So really it was, you know, 2-3 days at the gym, a bit of aerobic. I always liked aerobic workouts, so I probably focused more on that than what I should have.
To our listeners, he's not talking Oz style aerobics. He's talking cardiovascular aerobic. keep going, Nick.
That's a good clarification.
It's all good, mate. All good.
So we focused a lot on obviously explosive. So good strength and explosive.
Yeah.
Style workouts as well, but it was, you know, 6 days on, 1 day off.
Yeah,
sort of setup that wasn't. It was nothing outrageous. Yeah. It wasn't what you'd see. I'm sure if you went and looked at what the uni football team were on at that point in time, we would have been on a pretty cut down version of what they were getting.
And how many hours a week would you be training? So you were in the gym. What about when we're getting down onto the snow? What's a week in season down at the snow look like?
Yeah, so we worked on a 4 day cycle most of the time. So we'd ski 3 days and then have a day off, and we'd be working out in the gym all those 3 days as well, and then it changed a bit through the years, but basically we'd go on 3 days on, 1 day off for both skiing and dry land activities. But we'd focus on solid 3 days, rain, hail or shine. We had very little flexibility on those days or whether it got shifted around. And it was just day in, day out. So we'd ski in Australia, we'd do 2 months pretty much without a rest, without a break. Then we'd have a few weeks off after the Australian season finished, and then you'd move on to training in other locations. So once we'd made World Cup team, we'd go and spend another couple of weeks over in Switzerland through spring. Then obviously through winter was chasing the competition season.
Yeah, awesome. And who was your first coach?
My first coach.
Your mum?
Yep. Yeah. Definitely. If we look at official coaches, when I first started, it was under a guy called Simon Blundell, who was the freestyle coach at Thredbo. And so I skied under him for a couple of years. We then moved over to Perisher, where a man by the name of Peter Topalovic, or also known as Topper.
Yeah. Can we just go back to your first coach? What was the best thing he did for you, or a fond memory you have of working with him?
Oh, you put me on the spot with that one.
I think it's really interesting in reflecting on what athletes get out of a coach, you know, because it's often very different to what a coach thinks they gave you.
Yep.
You know, I was coached very briefly by a guy called Ray Lindrup, who was a cross-country ski coach. And the first thing that blew me away is there was such thing as a cross-country ski coach. And I'd never thought of this concept. And he just taught me a couple of little technical things that just changed the way I skied. And it's because I'd had no one had told me these things. And, you know, back when we started these sports like this fish, the internet wasn't the same as it is today. Okay. So tell us about Topper.
Yep. Topper. So Topper ended up being part of my life, or still is now. Mm. And so he took me all the way through from, you know, literally the third year into my mogul skiing to 10 years later at the Olympics me still. Wow. Not always my dedicated coach, but was always there. What he taught me about the sport, if we want to go there again, is just passion. He just loves it. Enthusiasm, passion, and just excited to be there. Mm. And that's one of the best things you can take out of going into sport, is just enjoying it. Have fun. Be around it. You want to be there. You want to enjoy it, and just have a great time. And that's probably one of the best things. You know, yep, a lot of technical, great technical stuff, but that attitude, taking that attitude with you every day is a huge impact on me and how I approached this.
What would Topper say to you if you're in a big competition and you failed in terms of what you were looking to achieve? You know, you didn't nail your jump, or you crashed, or whatever. You get to the bottom, you walk up to Topper. What would Topper say to you? Fuck you, you're an idiot. I'm going to coach someone else.
No. You missed it. You didn't get it. This is what we did wrong. Mm. Let's get it next time. Very, very calm about that, and positive approach to it.
There's a good parenting lesson in that, isn't there? Okay, so I want to fast forward a bit. One of the things that I think's most impressive is, having looked at your phys profile and knowing you for a while, what was your best ever international performance?
Well, luckily enough for me, that was the Olympics.
Yeah, okay. Now, from looking on your phys file, you must have raced, you know, 100 times, or competed 100 times, you know, on the World Cup and Europa Cup in Europe and stuff. Why did you do so well in the Olympics?
When I didn't do so well everywhere else?
Mate, can I tell you, like, obviously, if you were going to get to the end of your career and go, where am I going to have my best competition, we would have always said the Olympics, right?
Yep. So first approach to this is to look at the playing field. Yeah. So, and you're not going to like this answer, but I'm going to give it anyway.
No. There's no wrong answers here.
So at the Olympics, each country has a maximum of 4 competitors in mogul skiing at the time. Mm-hmm. So normally what you'd happen in your everyday World Cup event is you'd have
14 Norwegians guys, or something like that.
Exactly. So at the time, it was the Americans who were the stronghold, and they probably had 10, 12 guys who could rock up to a World Cup on any given day and have a chance of winning. Although they wouldn't be able to field that many in every World Cup, they'd field 7 or 8 often. So you then have 7 or 8 of them. You have quite a few Canadians and even, you know, some of the other countries. Yeah. So you end up having...
So it's a smaller field.
It's a smaller field, and the good countries are restricted. The countries with really good depth are restricted to that 4. So you've just got a few less people above you that you're competing against.
I'm hearing excuses here, and I want to know why you did so well.
I got lucky. I don't know if it was...
I'm just going to pause for a second there. I got lucky. So we're in 2006 here. You've been mogul skiing since 1991 or 1992 or something like that. I don't even want to do the maths on how many years that is. And you're telling me you got lucky.
On the day.
On the day. I love that attitude. It's like, I got lucky. It's like, mate, you've been working your butt off for 15 years at this stuff, you know, spending time away from your family. Your dad's at home working. Your mum's driving you down to the snow. You can't feel your feet. It's cold. It's wet. It's just, you know. Sorry, keep going. Yep. Tell me why else this was such a great event for you.
Now, I don't know if it's... I have no idea if it has anything to do with it because we didn't have... There was a crowd.
Yeah.
There was a crowd there. Now, yeah, whilst okay. I'm not a natural performer.
You're not an extrovert.
In any way, shape,
that's
or form.
True.
I'm definitely not an extrovert. it's an atmosphere.
Yeah.
You turn up to a World Cup event and for most of them, and there's no one there. No one. There might be a few people on the side. If you made finals, there would be, you know, there might be a crowd, but and there were at some events. I never made any of those finals where there was a crowd. But here you've got, you know, 10,000 people at the bottom of the run.
Yeah, wow.
It's a different playing field. There are cameras everywhere.
We were watching. Buzz, your friends were watching. Your friends were there, right?
Yeah, they were there, exactly. And so that was a different atmosphere to have so many people I knew there, my friends there, my extended family there. It was just really exciting. And I don't know if that was what changed everything. You can look at all the preparation and the work, but I'd done all of that to lead up to every other World Cup I turned up to as well, and didn't get that result. So honestly, I don't know how or why it happened to be the Olympics that I got my best ever result, but I did.
It's what you, I think what every athlete who sort of plays in the Olympic arena wants, right? They want that perfect race on that perfect day, you know.
Yeah.
So tell me, Australia's got a bit of pedigree in mogul skiing, and you know, in the last decade as Winter Olympic sports go, we've won medals and had world class athletes in there. Tell me a little bit what it was like to be on a team like that. So, you know, you've got guys that are competing for medals and what was it like?
Well, as you would know, with all the results you've got sitting in front of you, I was...
Just your results, mate. No one else's.
my teammate, Dale Beck-Smith, was obviously won gold in the event I was there for. So to have your teammate win a gold medal was pretty epic. Yeah. That was a pretty exciting time. And then, you know, he was literally on the cusp of being one of the best ever mogul skiers at least at that point in time. And it's being surrounded again, this comes back to, you know, you look at the quality of him as a skier, and that was something that we all wanted to aspire to. I obviously didn't make it there, but just being around that is seeing the ethics, the training, just seeing also come out just the raw talent and ability to hear something and change what you're doing, and it inspires you to continue doing it yourself, to push a little bit harder. It's always nice to feel like that your team is involved in. You know, you're taken seriously. Although it's an individual sport, you're still turning up as a bit of a team. And so, you know, Australia wasn't, you're Australian and you know how to ski, sort of question, which is a lot of what we got.
It's
this, oh no, like Australia, and you've got finalists, you've got medalists. And it wasn't only Dale, we had one other guy on the team who also got a medal at World Cup. I think it was in Olympic year as well. So there was a bit more depth. And obviously since then, Australian mogul skiing has just gone nuts, really.
Yes.
It's, with Matthew Graham, silver medal, multiple World Cup victories, Golden Globe victories. It's the whole sport's changed. And it's been a really good focus of the Skiing Australia, their effort and their attention and the amount of sort of work they've put into developing the programs and the skill set and how we coach everyone and all the training camps and everything like that has been just a monumental effort they've put in over the last 20 years to get it to where it is today. And just seeing it go from what it was when we came up, you know, we didn't even do training camps overseas until I was 18. Now they're off doing it when they're 12.
Yeah. So let's touch. I love what you said there. So we've gone from a place where Australia wasn't doing brilliantly in this sport. We've gone to a place that we are doing really well, right? I'm going to challenge you to really succinctly. I just want two or three reasons that what they've done. They've obviously put a lot of effort in it. Like I think you'll, you know, if you focus on something 9 times out of 10, it will get better. So how did they do it? You know, like looking back retrospectively, if you had a time machine and you went back to the 90s and go, guys, I'm in 2021 and I know that you guys have done a great job. These are the things you need to do. What are you telling them they need to do? Or what did they do? Put it a different lens, yeah.
Yeah, so what did they do? They started... I think they got funding and money to start with, and so they were able to They got resources, or they went into fight to get resources. And so that starts everything. Now you'd also and then we got a very good coach in who was my coach through World Cup, which was Steve Desevich. Very good coach in, and what they started then doing is implementing that coaching technique through the ranks and all the way down. So
resources led to a great coach. And then what else did they do?
And then they targeted talent.
Yeah.
So Australian skiing industry is quite small. Everyone's in a, you know, a small area and there's only a few mountains and they would hunt the talent down. Inter-schools skiing competition is the perfect breeding ground to find good talent because everyone's in the one spot doing the one event at the same time. And so you can compare everyone to everyone. And so they start seeing the good skiers, they start targeting them, and then they start coaching them the way they wanted them to be trained from a very young age.
So we could summarize that it's get the resources, get a great coach, find the talent.
I think so.
Cool. It's pretty cool to be part of, be that talent in there, hey.
Yeah.
You know. Yep. You're too humble, Fish. I love it. We're going to move on from skiing in a sec. A question I have for you is, any regrets? Anything that you go, God, I wish I'd done this.
Yep.
What's your regret?
When we were quite young, freestyle as a whole, and there was mogul and aerials skiing, right? At the time, moguls didn't do inverted tricks. Upright tricks, the very old school stuff. You can pull out some great hot dogger videos and you'll see what I'm talking about. But then there was aerials where you did all the flips and the spins and everything. So I trained both as a kid. And so I got quite good at inverting. Then you started off in those in those early days where people did both, and there was combined events where they'd compete moguls and aerials and, you know, combined scores, etc. would come into it. That disbanded, and you then had what ended up being just two separate
disciplines
that really didn't get a huge amount of overlap anymore. So the top mogul skiers weren't good aerialists, and it wasn't and the whole combined thing got disassembled. So what happened in this little period there where I wasn't doing aerials anymore is I stopped focusing on my inverted tricks ability.
And then it changed.
Then it changed and they brought inverted
Johnny Mosley, wasn't it? Was it Johnny Mosley?
It was Johnny Mosley, did his dinner roll.
Yeah.
I think it was 2002. He did that, and the Olympics before that, he did his 360 mute grab. Both of those events, the 98 and the 2002, changed the sport, revolutionized the sport. It came such a long way in that time. It was awesome. But through that time period, I must have gone from being, let's say, 15, 16 to 20, 21.
Yeah.
And I hadn't spent that time focusing enough on my jumping ability. So I went from being an excellent jumper in mogul skiing at that age, you know, at my first overseas training camp, I was doing 720 off one jump and a backflip, even though it wasn't legal in moguls. I could do a 720 and a backflip as my two tricks. And I never really progressed past that because we focused on the mogul tricks, focused on the uprights.
And so then you're by an the old time I got no new tricks.
Exactly. So that's one of my biggest regrets, probably, is not focusing on that. And then when they brought inverts into mogul skiing, I couldn't keep up. I tried, and by that time, I don't know if it was a mental block or whatever it was. I never was able to take it to the next level.
When did you decide to that competitive? Like, I know you still like doing the masters competitions, but when did you decide to step away from the sort of elite international level?
Yeah, so I stepped away in 2007. I did one more year after the Olympics in Torino. I had an okay year, but I went into that year on such a high of, right, I finished last year at the Olympics, best ever result. Like, I've learned how to compete now. Like, I've got my mental game back, like, or I've got it for the first time. Yeah. And so I was really excited to go into that year and really pumped. I think I had a really good result in Australia. So I think I won nationals that year as well.
You did.
and I was really keen. And then I didn't better my result. I didn't improve. I still didn't make a World Cup final in that next year. And actually the world champs at the end of that season was a double event. You always had a singles single event and a dual event.
Yeah.
And I crashed out in both. Mm. And it was demoralizing. I was pretty disheartened. And I walked away from that. I didn't make the decision on the day. I walked away and I almost thought I could feel a bit of flair coming back, and I was I was demoralized, but I'm like, no, I can find this, I can come back. But then after I got home, it started to wear off, and I got put in an ultimatum at the place I worked at the time. They basically said, look, they had supported me fantastically for many years and given me all the freedoms, but their business was growing, and they said we need to make this full time, or like no hard feelings if you want to go with skiing. Yeah. Absolutely no hard feelings at all, but we need to make a decision. And so I'd started to lose that, you know, that bit of motivation I had walking out of the season, and I had this put on me, and really I sat there and thought about it. I was 25, getting on in skiing years, hadn't yet got to that game, and with the mental blocks I had with my jumping, it was going to be hard for me to really keep up with the younger kids coming through. Yeah, and so I decided to pull myself out before I got pushed out, basically.
Had you met your wife yet?
I had.
Okay. I always think I know when I met Jazz, it was early in your relationship. The sport can quickly take a backseat, even if you're super motivated. I just want to dive into one more thing you said there. You felt like after the Olympics you got your mental game together, right? And you said that the thing at the Olympics that made it special was that it was a crowd, right? Do you think there was anything else? Like, what did you carry? So if it was the crowd that made you compete well at the Olympics, and you felt like when you went into that 2007 season, you had your mental game together, is it the confidence that the Olympics gave you then that was the part of the mental game, or was there something else that was, you know, giving you that hope that you could be more competitive?
I think it was that knowing I can turn up on the day and put down my best run.
Yeah.
Which is what I did at the Olympics. And, you know, very rarely on a World Cup event did I put down my best run. Like, yeah. I put down good runs, I put down solid runs, but never that next level. Now, I always carried through that. Obviously, there's always a bit of fear of, because in mogul skiing, it's one mistake and it's all over. And so there's this element of, now, having never really competed in other sports, but, you know, let's take running.
Yeah.
You know, the gun goes, and if if you miss your start in 100 meters, 200 meters, the early way, it's over. But often you can make up, or if you're running a 5,000, a 10,000, a marathon, 100%. But in mogul skiing, it's one little mistake, bang, and that's done. And so you're trying to carry through to make it, like, you've got to put it on the line, but you can't make a mistake. So I think what I learned there was just being able to compose myself to take that pressure of knowing that you've got to put everything on the line, but hold it all together and not let that defeat me. Because that's what I let it did me on that day.
Yeah, I see a lot of there's a lot of deep thought in that. There's a lot of complexity, and I also think and I think, you know, high performance everywhere, this is key, is I think there's a lot of perfectionism, you know, and I'm sure that most people would look at your very solid runs and go, that's brilliant, but, you know, to the highly trained eye, to your Topper or your Dez or whoever, would look at them and be able to those little things. So you touched on it just before about, you know, your employer saying, hey, it's time to either come in full time or we're gonna have to get someone else. Talk to me about what was happening in your career during this time. So, you know, early 2000s, you're skiing and you're at uni. What are you studying and what sort of work are you doing and what journey are you going on?
Yeah, so I studied throughout. So I did a combined engineering commerce degree. So I studied, that was a 5-year degree, which I did in the allocated 5 years. and that, it was only my last year at uni that I actually made the World Cup team. So I spent those first four and a bit years on the Europa Cup team. So there wasn't as much travel. There wasn't as much requirement to be away. And, you know, for the Australian season, I did my uni remotely. I found myself that I was one of the diligent people and I could study without turning up to uni. And what I actually found was that all my mates turned up to uni. They wouldn't go to their lectures. They'd go to the bar. They wouldn't read the lecture notes because they were turning up, but they'd talk during the lecture anyway. You know how it goes.
That's sort
of what people do. But I'd go, well, I'm missing the lecture, so I'm going to actually read the textbook and read all the notes and do all the exercises and do it all myself. So I'd actually come back from my skiing and be ahead of everyone else, which was very disheartening, I think, to a lot of people. Yes. But that, for me, that setup worked. So not having the distractions, not having people pulling me away, to just say, this is what I've got to get done. And it's no question. It's not a question of, am I going to do it? It's just a question of when and how am I going to do it? And that structure worked for me. Yes, I missed out a little bit on the practicals or the labs in engineering. Yeah, we had to turn up and do things. So there was a bit of figuring out how to make all that work. But really, in the grand scheme of things, it wasn't big enough to be insurmountable.
And then what sort of work did you start doing when you were part-time work while you were skiing?
Yeah, so I started with a company who did automation systems, telemetry systems for water and wastewater assets. So take a regional town somewhere, you've got a water treatment plant, sewage treatment plant, and some pumping stations that pump the water around, whether it's clean water or wastewater. So we did control for those things. So I started working for this company.
So in country towns, you turn the tap on, the water comes out. It's because of the systems. Then when you flush the toilet, it's taken care of. Yeah,
gets taken away. Sweet. That's right. So started working doing that, which was pretty much in line with what I did at uni. I got into that job through actually a friend of mine at uni, whose parents at the time owned own this company, and he asked me if I wanted to come in and give him a hand. And then, like I said, they supported me very well throughout the next four years while I was skiing on the on the World Cup circuit, allowing me to be away whenever I needed to. I worked remotely back then. So I worked remotely while I was traveling. So I was able to earn money while I was traveling to help fund everything that needed funding, which
I'm
was,
sure it was pretty cheap flying around the world doing lots of skiing.
There are more expensive sports, but it definitely gives it a bit of a push.
I think equestrians or yacht racing is probably about the only ones that are more expensive, mate. And then you're thinking about retiring from skiing, they're tapping you on the shoulder saying, hey, buddy, you got to get serious. Otherwise, we're going to have to find someone else. What do you do?
That's a decision that I made. I said, right now, I'm not sure I'm going to, and actually one of the big decisions, I should have brought this up earlier. One of the big, big things that went through my head on making that decision to stop was, in 4 years, do I think I'll be able to go back and better my result that I had? So in 2006, I came 12th. Yeah. In 2010, am I going to be able to go back and do better than that?
Yeah.
And so I'm, let's call it 25 at the time.
Yeah, you're nearly 30.
I'm going to be nearly 30. And I've got a mental block on my jumps. The jumps are getting more complicated. And the sport was becoming younger, not older at that point in time. Like the younger kids were starting to do better. And so the part of my decision was, especially with the tap on the shoulder, I really loved the job. I loved working with them. But it was tormenting.
Yeah.
But when I really sat there and thought about it and went, don't just do it again. And I think this comes back to don't live with something you'll regret either. Mm. Is if I spend the next 4 years of my life dedicated to this, am I going to walk away, or am I giving myself an opportunity to walk away with something more than what I've already got? Mm. And I boiled it down to that. Whilst there was a chance, it was a very small chance.
Sounds like you retired at the perfect time, right?
Yeah. Well, that's what I like to think anyway.
Just quickly, what did your coaches say when you said, I think I'm done?
I think there was agreement on that was probably a good decision.
Yeah.
Again, I mentioned before, pull out before you get kicked out.
Yeah.
I don't know that I was about to be kicked out, but I would have had to see some vast improvements to maintain my position.
Especially as
a lot of that is also focused around your age. So if they're happy to keep supporting you if you're at the top, as you're older. But if you're not at the top when you're older, and there are some kids coming through who are showing potential, that's where the funding is going to go, and that it makes perfect sense. And so I may have just got in early enough to avoid that happening to me.
We've finished our skiing. We say yes to this going full time in this job.
Yep.
Tell me about your first couple of years as a non-athlete, full time office person.
I started drinking coffee. Didn't drink any caffeine until that point.
An athlete that didn't drink coffee is pretty impressive.
Yeah. Didn't drink any caffeine at all. That came from earlier in life. I had some sleeping problems, and so cut caffeine out at a very young age. But then turning up to work every day just drove it right back in there.
What made you successful at your job? Why were you the guy that they wanted to make full time?
I think it might have been the attitude maybe that I learned from Topper. I took I wanted to be there. Yeah. I enjoyed it. I had fun doing it. I must have been reasonably good at it, otherwise they wouldn't have wanted me there anyway. But I just loved it.
Yeah.
It was just, I loved the work I was doing. I enjoyed it. I wanted to turn up every day and start doing whatever it was that I was doing.
So for those listening at home, Nick is really passionate about making sure the pump that moves the water around the local town is tip top going well. I love it. I love it. There's passion. And then I think when you look at a career, people get very impatient very quickly and go, oh, I haven't been promoted. I've been here for 6 months. And they underestimate what they can achieve over a long period of time, and they overestimate what they can achieve in a short period of time, right? And we reflect now, what are we sort of, you know, sort of 10, 15 years after that, and you're running your own business, you've got this successful business. At that point in time, did you have career goals, or were you just, hey, I'm passionate about this, I want to keep doing it?
At that point in time, I was just passionate about it. I just wanted to keep doing it. I'd never really thought I could handle running my own business. I never really wanted to. It was not something I had targeted myself for. Mm. It's something that just eventuated. So what happened was I spent a few more years working for this company, and then eventually decided to move on. Mm. And I found, well, I didn't find what I was looking for.
Yeah.
And that was something that really, really became quite a problem for me because I was...
I remember you moved through a few different places in a short period of time, right?
I did. I went through, you know, three or four jobs in less than 3 years.
Yeah.
I just couldn't find what I was looking for. I thought that doing all this programming, these automation systems and all this, I thought that's what I wanted. And that's what my brain was seeking. But then I took these other jobs doing similar things, but I wasn't happy. I'm not going to say I was depressed. That's the wrong word, but I was deflated. I was pretty down and I was bored. It wasn't what I enjoyed doing. And then I got a call from who soon became my business partner. Got a call saying that he thought there was an opportunity in the market, so staying in the same market, to to start up a new business and to go and try this out. And it was amazing, the switch that flicked in my head. Like, I talk about that switch I thought I had at the Olympics on, figuring out my mental state was one thing. The moment that I decided that I was going to start my own business, which is something I had never wanted to do, and my wife pushed me down this path, just saying, do it, you've got to do it, you're not happy with what you're doing, give it a go, because I would never have done it. I was way too conservative to even contemplate doing something like that. But the switch that flicked in my head, the moment that happened, was like, oh, that's what I was looking for. It wasn't. So this first company I'd started out at, I knew the owners. They took me on the journey of growing their business, and I only retrospectively can look back and see this, but that's what I enjoyed about it. I was helping them grow the business. They were including me in the discussions. It was still their business, but I was seeing it evolve. I was seeing the decisions being made. I was seeing the direction, and I was sort of included in that. And that's what had kept. That's why I was so passionate about it. And then, as I said, the moment this started. And I became a different person, completely different person. I was happy again. I was motivated. I was probably now all consumed by it. So it probably impacted other areas of my life, which my wife will probably tell you that I was a little bit too committed to it. But that's where it was. And what I found, I was just happier again.
I think there are very few things in life I think you can achieve at a really high level and not be slightly unbalanced. Like, no one looks at someone who's a really good long-distance runner and go, oh, you have a balance. You know, they run too much. That's why they're good at it. You know, you want to run. No one says to a lawyer, you're a brilliant lawyer, but you don't work very much, And I think the thing is, when you're into something that you're really passionate about, it doesn't feel like it's hard work. You know, as I was saying, do something you're passionate about, never work a day in your life, you know. And I think you're talking about how you found that. Talk to me about the evolution. Like, you had a business partner in that business, you know. How did you start? Where are you now?
Yep. So, yeah, we started out just the two of us. Yeah. He was based in a different geographical location.
Yep.
Out in central New South Wales, and we
close to the Dunnies and the Taps.
Exactly right.
Yep.
And we started knocking on doors.
Yeah.
He had quite a few contacts in there that enabled us to get started.
Great.
Pretty quickly, which is nice to get your first few customers. Mm. Now, being a service industry, not a products industry, where I went into, it's a lot easier to get started. You don't need the big financial backing. You just need a bit of time to be able to do that. And with a few contacts, you can very quickly start selling your own time. So it's, as far as being able to start a business, it's a relatively, not risk-free, but a lot lower risk than
cost is your energy and your time, right? Rather than if you're building a widget, you know, and it doesn't sell, you've got 1,000 widgets sitting in your backyard.
Yeah, that's it. And
where are you now?
Where are we now? So we're now at 15 people, spread through Brisbane and Sydney, and obviously my old business partner out in Parks. So he decided to exit the business to go and retire. Mm-hmm. I brought him out earlier this year, and so it's me.
Yeah. Wow.
Which is, again, you feel like you're out on your own. It was always good. I found especially starting out, having someone to work with and to bounce ideas off, to work through things, to have that same sort of joint energy into trying to start something like this was great. And I don't think I probably couldn't have done it without him there. But then when you take over it, like we're at different stages of life. He's now in his 60s. I'm just turning 40. So we're in different life stages. And so now you really feel that on your own feeling when you go up, you come in and it really is just you. One of the biggest things I learned in starting my own business was you become the last line of defense, basically. Like when things go wrong or someone needs a problem solved, for not wanting to use cliches, the buck stops with you.
100%. It's a bit like being a parent.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. And so sort of this I really have to own this decision. And the mental growth and development I felt myself go through on just that one realization there of it's all on me now. And whether that's true or not, because there's always other avenues, and you know there's a lot of support you get, like you know the support from my family, whether it's my wife, my parents, my friends. Yeah. There's always support around. There's always someone else you can try and call. But to me, it was that feeling of no, it's my business. It stops here. I have to solve this problem. And that in the first couple of years was just an incredible thing to work through mentally on 2 o'clock in the morning when something's not working. You can't just go, I'm done. It's, you make it work. And that's it. There's no two ways about this.
So what's unique about Nick Fisher that has helped you be successful in this?
I've thought about this question.
Good.
And I think the one thing I probably say that I do well is I keep turning up.
Yeah.
It's turning up every day and just keep working on it. So like you say, don't expect too much in the short term, but you can you can build up to something in the longer term. Keeping on turning up, showing up every day, working your hardest. something good has to come from that, right? And taking 100%. That mentality of it is what I took with skiing. I didn't put the pressure on myself of having to achieve the Olympics, but I knew if I just turned up time and time again and kept working on it, something good should come from this. And that's what I've taken. And again, through my business, through the bad times, I'm not the most productive person every day, but I turn up and keep turning up and keep putting myself through it, and things happen.
No, I think that's really true. If you reflect on your however many years you've been running your business, what advice would you give to someone who's at that point where, gosh, I'm unhappy in my job, I want to do this myself, I want to have a successful business? What would you say to them?
I would still err on the side of caution, because it depends what you're seeking. If you're going out, if you're starting your own business because you want to make money, I'd be very wary. If you're going out to do something because that's simply your passion, I'd be very wary. I know there's a lot of schools of thought on this, and if you find your passion, go and do that, and that'll be right. I'm not sure I agree with that. It still has to be viable. There still has to be a market need for it. And so I would say give it a shot, but make sure you've thought through what you're giving a shot first. But again, don't not do something and then think you'll live to regret it later. So do it, give it a go, think it through first.
I like this. I'd call you the tenacious engineer, because you've got this real tenacity and achievement drive to keep pushing, right? But you still got this sort of cautious personality that's thinking about everybody from everything from every perspective. And I think that's one of the challenges when you run a business, is you've got to think about everything from every perspective. You've got to make sure the HR issues are sorted, the IT issues are sorted, but then you also have to do the bloody engineering work that's involved in doing it. Imagine we're sitting here in a couple of years' time, you know, maybe 5-10 years, and you're really proud of where your business has got to in that time. What are some of the things you'd like to have achieved?
Well, the problem with business is there's an ever moving goalpost. So the moment you achieve something, well, that's not enough anymore, because you can always go a step further.
Highlighting your perfectionism here, Nick.
You put a sporting goal, you've got an event coming up, the intent is to win it. And once you win it, you then start going on, and again, you can do it. Are you going to be the best ever? You know, you look at the tennis guys at the moment, who's going to be the greatest of all time? And you know, so that it's, you can still push it there, but I think with business, there's so many more angles and there's so many more ways that it can play out, but there's so many different ways the goalposts can move that you're almost never going to be happy with where you get it to. So what would I like to see? If you'd asked me 5 years ago and you told me I was going to have a team of 15 people, I would have said that if I was able to achieve that, that's going to be awesome, and I'd be quite happy with that. Now I'm here, I sit there going, well, no, I can do better than that. So what would I want to see in the next 5 to 10 years? I think I'd like to get to a point where it's comfortable. I don't want to be, the big company. I don't want to be around there. I want to be comfortable. I'd like to be able to afford to buy a house in Sydney. Yes. Is that too optimistic?
Might need 150 employees, Nick. Sorry, buddy. No. That's good. What are you most proud of in your work? What makes you sit back? Is it when you install one of these, Dunny and Tap systems, and it all works well, and you go, or is it your clients going, oh, you're amazing? What is it that drives you?
So, in my earlier years, what drove me was, I love watching things work. So, you write the program and you're controlling all this equipment. So what I liked a lot about it is there's moving parts to it. I'd always thought about maybe I wish I'd done mechatronic engineering instead of electronic engineering, just to get a bit more movement and moving parts.
Okay,
in it.
Just pause right there. Can you explain that to a normal person? What is mechatronic engineering?
It's a mixture of mechanical and electrical.
Okay.
Engineering. So you bring a lot more moving parts. So it, you know, yeah, robotics or things along those lines. Okay. Is just to write a program to make something do something is what made me happy.
Yeah.
And that's, I sat there in all these different places and you do a treatment plan and you've got to turn this pump on, turn that valve, open that valve, make the water go from here to there and then back to here and there again. And that was awesome. I loved it. Mm. Now it's sort of changed to, I like people enjoying working with our company. So what I like to hear is our customers have had a good experience. It's not just we got the job done and we got the job done properly and we did it efficiently and well and we made money and blah blah blah. No. If the customer turns around and just goes, said, I actually enjoyed working with you guys.
Yeah.
So it's more than just being a good engineering company. It's making it. It's still life. So we've got to go through it and we've got to have fun doing it. And so making the environment like that. So again, I like people wanting to turn up to work and to be happy about turning up to work, to enjoy coming in, and to obviously achieve good engineering results. But it's life. You spend so much of your life working that you've got to make it happy, and you want to make it a happy experience for your customer, a happy experience for your staff, and yourself.
Yeah. That's awesome. Mate, we're gonna wrap up. This has been such an interesting conversation for someone that I've known for so long, finding out all these amazing details about you. I want you to leave one thing. I think you've obviously got a great attitude towards self-improvement and goal setting. You're very driven. You know, if someone's listening to this and go, "Hey, I want to try and get better at what I do, and I want to perform at a higher level," and you know, it's probably not skiing in the Olympics and it might be running a company with 15 employees, but what would you say to them?
I think what I said before, and if you want to do it, turn up.
Yep.
Keep turning up.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid of hard work. It takes hard work, but you can do it and you will improve, you will get better, and you'll be surprised at what you can achieve by just continuing to knuckle down and get it done.
Yeah. And a last thought, and this is a deliberately challenging question. What are you most proud of in, you've been on Earth for 40 years, what are you most proud of?
About myself, or just most proud of?
Yeah, what are you proud of? You're proud of, you know, kids, your wife, your work, your Olympics, you know, you're running a 15-person company that everybody's, you know, impressed by.
Oh, that's a very hard question. That's a very hard question.
It's deliberate.
I think I'm most proud in seeing other people, motivated from something I've done, or from something I've helped them with, or something
great
they can achieve. I think that makes me proud.
Yeah,
so,
cool.
You know, obviously I love my family. I have an amazing wife. My kids are amazing.
Good.
But what am I most proud of?
Yeah.
I find that a tough challenge, it's
supposed to be hard because I think people define, you know, what they're proud of. You know, I thought when I was 25, I would be most proud of how much money I earn every year, you know, and that's not something that is important to me now. You know what I mean? And I think we go through different things, and I actually think that, you know, that's, you know, the textbook will actually tell the happiest people are the ones that help people, you know, like that is actually trademark. You know, what the textbook would tell you. Well, Nick, thank you for being my very, very first ever podcast host, and I hope that this podcast helps inspire people, and that can further make you happy, and we get lots of downloads. Hey,
all the best with the podcast, Joe. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for listening to my first episode of High Performance with Joe Sprange. I really enjoyed my conversation with Nick. Nick credits his success to several keys: working hard, turning up every day, positive coaching and support, and doing what you're passionate about. I feel he underestimates his strong self-awareness and his ability to critically analyze his own performance. I hope you can join me for the next episode.